But I did find myself really moved. And I found myself really connecting to this idea of like, what happens if you've found the person or persons that make you whole, but you found them in the wrong life?
You're listening to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad?
Yes.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas, Veronica. Starting right in with the funny, funny joke.
It's your funny, funny joke, so I'm just lobbing it back at you.
I'm sure it's a thing somewhere, but people talk about Thanksgiving, and I'm like, there's got to be a Christmas, so... Oh, well, if there's not a Christmas, there now is, and we are trademarking it right after this recording.
Yeah, this is the Christmas home.
Welcome to the Merry Christmas episode of the Brightwall Darkroom podcast.
Big year for Tom Cruise.
I mean, kind of every year for like 30 years has been that, right?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, define, I didn't say good, but big. Big year.
Well, I would say the opposite. They've all been good years for Tom Cruise, but I don't know about every year being a big year for Tom Cruise, but this one in particular, big year. Maverick.
Yeah, I know.
Let's talk about it again.
We're just going to jump right in there. I don't know. Well, we haven't talked about Tar yet, but if you want to go straight to Maverick, we can do that.
Lydia Tar will never be canceled. Tar, melodrama, it's a movie.
If we could get him to work with Joanna Hogg.
Yeah.
So all right. Got all that stuff out of the way.
Episode done.
I love Top Gun Maverick. I will say again, as I will say anytime anyone asks me, and I'm still surprised that I loved it so much, but I still really, really love it.
Why did it surprise you that you liked it so much?
I just really thought it was going to be an okay movie, and I didn't think that they were going to get the nostalgia part right, and I'm a really big mark for nostalgic stuff, but if it's even slightly off, then I just hate it with like a vitriolic passion because I'm mad that they ruined the nostalgia. So this on paper, I think I would have, even reading about it, I would have said, this is not going to work, and then you watch it, and it was just, I mean, I run out of ways to say it was amazing, but... Part of it was a theatrical experience. I remember, you know, talking about that a while ago. But
yeah.
Being back in the theater, taking my son, you know, I'd gone with my parents when I was a little kid. Because, bizarrely, the original one is rated PG, and so I was able to see it. I really liked so much about it. I really still am so conflicted on how I feel about Tom Cruise as a person, even as an actor. But to be really cliched, it was the role he was born to play.
Yeah.
And he does really good, and he's vulnerable, which... I think he's performed vulnerability before, but here he actually feels a little bit vulnerable, if that makes any difference. Hmm. Just about the fact that he's approaching, what, 94 years old now?
Yeah, him and Frederick Wiseman.
Deep cut.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I definitely think in the Mission Impossible film,
the
most recent Fallout, he's also, like, especially in the bathroom scene with Henry Cavill. Oh, yeah. When he's like huffing and puffing, we're really getting a sense that his respiratory health is not what it used to be. But whose is?
I like that you refer to that movie as recent, because I know for you it's just happened and the next one's coming out tomorrow. And
oh my God, it's eternal for me.
You live in a Mission Impossible world. I know. I love you. I love your love for those movies.
I do. What was it, 2018? And now the next one's coming out next year. Yeah, but every time I see the trailer for part one, I start crying. So.
Like, what kind of tears are they?
It's like ecstasy, like sort of the classical sense. Okay. Yeah. I'm brushing up against the sublime, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have some high hopes for that one.
I do, but I mean, it could be trash and I would just gobble it up probably. So.
I'll even stand up for the second one. I think all of those movies are great. So.
Oh, yeah. I like the second one.
This one's not going to be trash. I mean,
the Notorious remake.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, even though the "they" implied there has changed hands many times.
but now it's stabilized.
Yeah, Christopher McQuarrie certainly knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. Like, it would be like if the James Bond movies were like, you know, never mind, we've picked just one guy now.
Well, they did that, right? With Daniel Craig.
No, I mean with the director.
I know.
And Daniel Craig eventually is going to have to do some weird crossover with the Rian Johnson character, you know, from the Knives Out thing. And then, wait, he's not even James Bond anymore, is he?
No, because he died.
Daniel Craig?
No, James Bond.
Oh, really?
Yes. Daniel Craig's James Bond. Have you not seen that one, the most recent one?
Is there any tradition of revealing secrets at the holidays?
Only that Santa's not real.
I've seen one James Bond movie in my life.
Wow. So you have a lot of work to do over this winter break.
Or I don't.
Okay. All right.
I saw the original. I saw it so that I would understand more of the Austin Powers jokes.
Wow.
Yeah, like 20 years ago.
Okay.
I did read the book novelization of the Timothy Dalton one, which would have been, what, Something to Kill, Dressed to Kill, Born to Kill, Time to Kill. Kill me for reading this.
So you saw Her Majesty's Secret Service? Is that the one that you watched?
I believe I watched Dr. No.
Oh, okay.
Was that the first one?
No.
What was the first one?
I believe it's Her Majesty's Secret Service, but I could be wrong. I don't have like a tab open. My computer's too old to check things and record at the same time.
Our guest is just having to be so quiet.
Oh, Dr. No is first. Okay. Well,
yes.
Fine.
I am the Bond trivia expert, by the way.
You are once again restored as the man on our show.
Yes.
Okay. Should we talk a little bit about what we're actually going to talk about this month, which is rom-coms?
Yeah.
We're in the middle of the Venn diagram between Tom Cruise and rom-coms. Why rom-coms for December?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, too, I mean, I'm not even going to attempt to make a case for this as a rom-com, except for in little flashes. So this was more about Cruisemas.
Okay.
And when thinking about it, it was like there's an obvious Tom Cruise movie we could have picked for a rom-com, even from the same director.
Jerry Maguire. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're just going off script there. That's not nearly as much fun to talk about.
No. In the spirit of continuity.
Yes.
We have our special guest, Elizabeth Cantwell.
Hello.
Hey, Elizabeth.
I'm here.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Chad, you want to introduce Elizabeth?
I do so badly. Well, there's a rhyme and reason to this besides just that we love Elizabeth, which is that she was on our much loved internally and from the few stats that we see externally as well, episode on Eyes Wide Shut last Christmas, which was so much fun to do. It's one of the only shows that I go back and listen to every now and then because it just really makes me laugh a lot and I really enjoyed it. So we wanted to make sure that we had her back on the show for this Christmas episode on Vanilla Sky, which I should say is the movie we're discussing. So joining us today, one of my favorite people on Earth still, someone who's been with Bright Wall Dark Room since just really the very, very beginning, way back on Tumblr in 2009. She was our first managing editor from 2013 to 2016 and then returned in 2020 and is now an editor and a regular contributor to the site. She's also the chair of humanities at the Webb School, where she shapes impressionable young minds. And she's the author of two poetry collections, Nights I Let the Tiger Get You and All the Emergency Type Structures. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here. I am a huge Tom Cruise fan. I love him. He can do no wrong in my eyes, except everything he does with Scientology. But we're throwing that out the window in a stunt.
We got to throw out some stuff.
No, this movie, I'm interested to hear what our conversation will be like. It's one of those movies that kind of troubles me when I think about it because it's so odd. Even as I was taking notes for this episode, I kept finding myself unsure if I was liking things or not liking things. But yeah, I'm very excited to be here and talk about this strange, not romantic comedy movie.
Mm. Yeah, what kind of genre would we... Do we want to put a genre on it?
Well, we should say what it is first.
Okay. Let's do that.
It's a film.
We're talking about Cameron Crowe's 2001 film, Vanilla Sky. You know, it's been generically described a lot of different ways. But before we get into like the synopsis of the film, we thought it would be nice to hear from our producer slash editor, Eli Sands, who has not seen the film, knows nothing about it, and is going to grace us with a speculative description of the film based on some keywords. I thought we could throw out like five just to give him something to like chew on. Okay. So I'm going to put out Mask and Monet.
Mask and Monet? Mm-hmm. As in Claude Monet?
Yeah. I'll throw in Fuck Buddy. And
well, that's going to be hard to top.
Car crash.
And car crash.
Let's see. Tech support and something's wrong with his arm.
Okay. Two friends with benefits discover a long-lost Monet painting titled Vanilla Sky. And on the night of a mask party at the Louvre, they decide to stage a heist to get away with this painting. They discover it, and then it's in the Louvre, and they have to steal it, which, you know, makes a ton of sense. As they're driving the getaway car, there is a crash, and Tom's arm gets hurt.
I mean, kind of.
They have to call tech support of people, which is the hospital and doctors.
Wow.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
How did I do?
Not the Louvre.
The Louvre. Someone's seen the movie.
It's not bad.
Clearly.
It made more sense, actually.
Wow. We never would have thought this movie could be so easily demystified, but just with a few key words.
I'm not actually on the money, am I here?
You landed on it.
There's some stuff.
It's like that AI chatbot, honestly. I feel like we just gave you the ingredients.
Chat ELI.
Yeah. Chat ELI.
Doll Eli.
Solved it.
L-E.
L.E. There you go.
L.E. Yeah. The genre of this film is like, it's the same genre as, well, I think right before this film came out, both Memento and Mulholland Drive also came out, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the genre of like, is it a dream or is it real life? Which I don't know if that's a genre, but it kind of is.
Is now.
Yeah. Puzzle films.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this film does it badly.
Yes.
But maybe Veronica disagrees.
Veronica's waiting to make her case.
Yeah.
I thought for sure you would hate this, Veronica.
Really? Why? Why did you think I would hate it?
Had you seen it before this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I hadn't seen it in like at least 10 or 15 years, and I was embarrassed that I owned the DVD and used to proclaim that this was a really good movie, because it was just like, yikes, this is... I'm very curious to hear what you think, because I'm sure that you'll present a very good case for it that will make me feel okay about liking it.
No, I don't have like a good case. I mean, what you're saying is how I feel about Almost Famous, which I loathe.
No, I know. And I know I knew that we'd get into that, and I was going to try to steer us around that peacefully.
Pew, pew, pew.
Because I know you hate. That was my favorite movie of the year before. So I was so excited for Vanilla Sky. And the original Aubrey Los Ojos was, I mean, that if you came into Scarecrow Video for 2 years there from like 98 to 2000, 100% I was pushing that movie on you when you walked in the door, even if you'd already seen it.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I was so obsessed with it. And I, after watching Vanilla Sky again last night, I am pretty terrified to watch the original, because I'm like, oh, God, is that going to be, you know, one of those cringe things like where you liked, you know, like a Stone Temple Pilots song back in the day? Or is it going to be more like, oh, no, hey, this really aged well. I was prescient and smart. But I'm worried that it's not based on the director's career that kind of fell off a cliff. Around 2004 or 2005, so.
Yeah.
I mean, there's moments in this film that are not bad.
Generous.
And there are like, there are moments where you're like, this is great. I'm enjoying this. This is fun. This is weird. This is wacky. I think the thing that I will give the film and the performances in it is that everyone, it's my favorite thing. I feel like I've probably said this before, is that everyone is making choices. They are making choices, and they are committing to those choices. And not all of the choices are good, but they are going for it. And so I feel like in that way, I do respect the film, where it's like, all right, they're really doing it. Like Tom Cruise is really, he really has that mask on, and he's doing a weird dance in the window of a jail. And I don't know why that is happening.
Never explained. I like that part.
I don't know why, but I'm here to witness that choice.
And a lot of times it's like as if they didn't talk with each other about what it is they're all going for. They're all kind of individually going for their own thing. It's bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, well, we got to summarize the movie to talk better about it.
I was just thinking too, all the connections with Eyes Wide Shut. So we should get to that.
Okay, let's do synopsis.
All right.
Okay, so Vanilla Sky is Crow's adaptation, or as he's put it, the punk cover of Alejandro Amenábar's 1997 movie, Abre los Ojos. Here, Tom Cruise plays rakish young publishing nepo baby David Ames. David has two friends, a fuck buddy in the form of Julie Gianni, who is played with deranged genius by Cameron Diaz, and an author called Brian, played by fraternal Tom Cruise doppelganger Jason Lee. In the course of one evening, David falls in love with Brian's party date, dancer and proto-manic pixie dream girl Sophia Serrano, played by Penelope Cruz, who also stars in Amenábar's original film. The morning after talking all night with Sophia, David accepts a ride from Julie, who may or may not have followed him, and she ends up driving them both off a pretty low bridge, killing herself and disfiguring David in the process. Unless So basically, for the rest of the film, like a surrealist choose-your-own-adventure, we end up being teased with what's real and what's dreamt, flitting between a masked David in custody for murder, chatting with a prison psychologist, a fully healed David living happily with Sophia, and a desperately unhinged David grappling with the possibility that the consciousness he's experiencing is an elaborate biotech-enabled lucid dream. We get relentless needle drops, many of which are iconic and I stand behind today, armchair art criticism, cameos by Michael Shannon and Tilda Swinton, and Cameron Diaz's iconic line reading, "I swallowed your cum, that means something."
Very different than what I thought.
Not at all different. Not that different.
And then they go on a heist at the Louvre.
Yeah, except for the heist plot. I feel like you really hit some of those big milestones.
No, I love Cameron Diaz in this movie. I think she's so strong in this movie at being completely unhinged. And yeah, her lines, Veronica, I saw when I was looking in the notes for the podcast that you had that line, "I swallowed your cum, that means something," which I had also written down, of course. But Chris and I also will forever say to each other, "When you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise." Your body makes a promise. She's crazy in this. I love it.
She's so crazy. But she's also like doing a crazy turned up version, I feel like, of what she's doing in every other movie, which I really appreciate. There's a kind of just like bald self-parody. And it always makes me think of Lost in Translation and how the actress character there, I think, is meant to be based on Cameron Diaz, and how much
that, yeah,
better Cameron Diaz is at sending herself up than this kind of version of her that is parodied in Sofia Coppola's film. Everything she's doing, including the, like, you know, it's not just the sort of scary bits of her performance where she's stalking David and she's being a little bit too
much
intent. Yeah, too pursuant, but also the parts when she's trying to be sort of sexy, like there's a, not to jump, I mean, I think we just have to jump around with this film.
Oh yeah, the movie jumps around.
Yeah, when there, that sex scene where we're not sure if he's hallucinating or if reality is shifting, but basically she and Penelope Cruz's Sophia are, it's toggling between them who he's sleeping with in that moment, even though he's humping continuously the entire time.
Yes, he does not stop with the thrusting.
In that scene, doesn't he put his hand up on the wall and it's the geo wall? Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, actually. Maybe.
The geo wall? What's a geo wall?
No, the jail. The jail wall.
Oh, jail wall. I thought it was some new technology.
Like, I'm pretty sure when we see his hand on the wall in the sex scene, his hand is actually on the wall of the jail.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and I thought the little, by the way, the little dance in the jail, I thought was calling back to the thing when he's dancing in the club.
Oh.
I loved that.
I love that club scene.
Which is a great scene, by the way.
Yeah. Iconic. Yeah.
That's maybe my favorite one because he's just not talking and there's just music.
It's great.
Because, yeah, I want to get to his performance too. Because I still can't, like, Elizabeth put, I read the notes before I watched it again, and I don't know, it might have been front, one of you guys said, like, is this a bad performance on purpose? Like, he's a good actor by this point, and this is the most bizarre performance where it's like, imagine if you didn't know how to act and were trying really, really hard to do it through like a lot of the movie, and then sometimes you can act just to remind people and mess with them. But it was so bizarre, and you're making so many faces at me.
It feels to me sometimes like they took the takes that normally you would throw out. You know what I mean? Where it's like, normally when you do a take and the director's like, cut, like, we got to redo that. They just like, they're like, let's use that one.
Yeah. And usually what they say after that is like, hey, bring it down a little. But yeah, everything is pitched really high. And which again, when you find out some of this maybe is a dream, then it makes more sense. Like, oh, maybe he's trying to do this performance that is off in this way that kind of subtly hints to you that you're in a dream. But again, in Eyes Wide Shut, he does the opposite, where he's like, well, I'm just going to turn off all of my wattage. And here he's like, I'm going to turn off some of the worst parts of what you think of Tom Cruise. And I'm also going to act really weirdly throughout the movie and not be sympathetic in any way as a character, which is not his fault.
Why does anyone like him?
The character.
Yeah, the character. Like, why does anyone in the film like him?
That also haunted me from the notes. I was like, I was looking for reasons. I was like, oh, wait, he's completely unlikable. But Cameron Crowe keeps trying.
Yeah, I don't know why Brian likes him. I don't know if Brian is real, though.
I don't know if Jason Lee is real.
Well, okay, here's the thought that I have. I know that a lot of the movie is like his own lucid dream that he's created, right?
Maybe.
And I think that, for me, that's where some of my criticisms of the movie come in is because it feels to me like we're being plunged into the subconscious of someone who is completely uninteresting, where he has the most Visco girl taste, like the most basic taste, where he's like, in my apartment, I have a Buddha souffle, Jules Jim, a Claude Monet. I have a guitar. My favorite album is Bob Dylan.
But that was part of the point.
And it's so boring. And then his like lucid dream, therefore, is him pulling from like the most boring content in the world, where he's like, what do I know? A Claude Monet. Let's put that in. That's my lucid dream. And in that way, it does dovetail to me with Inception, which is like, in my subconscious, there are brutal modernist buildings and streets. Like, it just feels so boring to me. But I also wonder if some of this seems to be Cameron Crowe, like, lucid dreaming his own filmography in a way, like dropping references to his own movies. Like, we have, he's already worked with Tom Cruise. Yeah. He'd worked with Jason Lee. There's also, I know we need to talk about Citizen Dildo, but if you go back to Cameron Crowe's movie Singles, which I don't really like, Citizen Dick.
I didn't even realize that until you said it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, what is going on here?
That's a deep cut. Well, and also the very, very, very end, right before the moment that everything, when it's a montage of like a bazillion images at once, really bizarrely throwing Martin Luther King in there really quick.
Yes.
Was a lot of those pictures and images are of Cameron Crowe in his own life as a kid, like mixed in with all this pop culture. So he really was like, yeah, this is all me. Bye bye.
So does Cameron Crowe see himself as David Ames?
I don't know.
Oh, man.
Veronica's been quiet.
I just really like this movie. I don't know. Like, thinking about, okay, like, what I like about this movie is, like, really, really literal and, like, straightforward, I would say, and, like, earnest. I don't care which parts are dreams versus reality at all. I could not care less, probably. I don't care. Like, I read so many articles last night that are, like, 50 Easter eggs in Vanilla Sky. That did nothing for me. I think it is interesting how much Cameron Crowe pulls from his own life for his films. So this idea of like how even though this is a non-original work, a remake or an adaptation, but that he's still somehow finessing it so that it can be about himself, I think is extremely persuasive. And I love all of those like connections that you just revealed to us, Elizabeth. I completely forgot that there's that reference in Singles. That's great. I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah.
But like, much like Mulholland Drive, the things that resonate with me with this film are just like normal feelings-based things. Like, this is what it would be like to fall in love really quickly, to be aware that you had made a thoughtless decision that transforms the course of your life in a really tragic way, to be vain and to be altered physically in such a way that you are unrecognizable to yourself and others, to inherit like a place in the world that you don't deserve and can probably never prove that you do. All of those things, like, I don't know.
To snowboard.
I haven't thought about the snowboarding.
He talks about it way too much for it not being a plot
point. He really does. Just snowboarding through my life.
Here's my snowboard. It's a painting, but it's a snowboard.
I made it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to explain these stores of patience that I have for both the film and the character.
But yeah, what do you think about the character? Not about everything else around contextually and the dreams and all that stuff. Like, why would anybody like him to Elizabeth's point? Like, why would he have this friend besides looking like Tom Cruise? Why would he have these girls?
Well, there is no besides looking like Tom Cruise. I mean, the idea that there is a besides looking for Tom Cruise is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, think of like anyone beautiful and or rich that you know.
Yeah.
People love them because they're beautiful and or rich. Like, that's a main central appeal.
That's true.
People probably don't want to admit that, but
no. And well, they're also very not forgiving of the fact that he was horribly disfigured. They're like, a month later, like, dude, come on, you're kind of a dick now. And I was like, he just had his face like disfigured.
Yeah, I don't think these are like deep friendships.
Yeah.
You know?
He is being a dick though.
Yeah.
But throughout the movie, he's being, well, and I did read something from some Cameron Crowe interview. He had a lot of interviews around this time. He was very high on this movie until it did what it did, and then he didn't bring it up too much anymore. But I remember the pre-Vanilla Sky press junkets he was going. He was really just acting like they had made this whole new thing. And he kept calling it, like you said, this cover. You know, we're not remaking the film. We're covering it like how bands do. And he's, you know, trying to do all this stuff. But the original one, you know, without Tom Cruise in there, have you guys seen any of it?
I have not seen it.
I looked it up, but no.
Okay. So, I mean, it changes it completely. And the bizarre thing, just if you have seen that one and you are recommending it to people forever, and then they come out with another version where everything is just way different, but it's the same exact story. So it is like a cover, but then they put Penelope Cruz in there. So it's more like if you're covering a Beatles song, but then you call like Paul McCartney up to the stage to help you do it. So it's not quite. And Eli, the movie does end with an original Paul McCartney track called Vanilla Sky, because Cameron Crowe worked really, really hard to get the phrase Vanilla Sky into the movie. And he goes through all these perambulations about why in this interview. And then at the end, he's like, I just actually like the way the words sound together, which I think is actually more true of what the movie is. Its animating spirit is. I just like that I can recreate a Bob Dylan album cover in this scene. I just really like using the Porpoise song during this really bizarre sex scene. Some of the needle drops really, really work. And then some are like very 2001, in my opinion. The Joan Osborne one.
Going back to what Veronica was saying, I will admit that the first time I watched it, I saw it as like a spectacle. And it wasn't that long ago. It was like 2 or 3 years ago. And I was like, this is silly and crazy. And parts of it I laughed at. And parts of it I was like, what is happening? This time through, I did cry at the end. And I was surprised. To my credit, I'm sleep deprived. I have a 4-month-old. Yes. My 5-year-old has been sick. Like, I'm not getting a lot of sleep. So maybe we blame the sleep deprivation. But I did find myself really moved by Tom Cruise's death scene. And I found myself really connecting to this idea of like, what happens if you've found the person or persons that make you whole, but you found them in the wrong life? I think about that sometimes with, I mean, this is like semi-serious, but with all of the chaos in the world around us. And sometimes I think I look at my family and I go like, oh my God, I have this beautiful family. And like, what a shit time to have this beautiful family. Mm.
I know that feeling very well. Yeah.
But that also then gets me to one of the problems I still have with the movie is that it kind of posits two forms of resurrection that, that don't mesh together. Mm. There's the cryogenic freeze resurrection, which is a literal, like I will be resurrected as myself, and they'll fix my face, and then I will live out the rest of my life in 150 years in the future.
Yeah.
But then there's this, in another life, we will both be cats resurrection, which is like, good, that's like the karmic Buddhist, like, I will be reborn and I will find you somewhere, which to me is more like beautiful, and I like that idea a lot better. Because if he jumps off the building and then just becomes David Ames again, 150 years in the future, he's not going to find Penelope Cruz because she's dead.
No.
And he's not a cat yet.
But her great-great-great-great-granddaughter.
Oh, come on.
How the movie should end is when he opens his eye, it should be a cat eye.
Oh, yeah, my that's good. God. Duh.
That's how it should end.
Get Cameron on the phone.
He should open his eye, abre los ojos, and it should be a cat eye. I think that would be beautiful.
That would be on Reddit for forever. So many theories. I'd also like to see a cat a feline version of this film.
Oh, I would love that. No, this gets me into, like, I just really quickly need to say that when he opens his eye at the end. So at the end, okay, just in case you have never seen the movie, which at this point you probably turned the podcast off if you haven't seen the movie. But if you haven't seen the movie, he chooses to be resurrected from this cryogenic freeze and to resume life because he wants to like take another chance at it. And it's like this beautiful, like, I will choose every moment you have a chance to like choose something.
Carpe diem.
And then you see his eye open and you're like, oh man, like he woke up from the freeze. It's gonna be real now. But the eye that you see is like a weird color and it's kind of like purple in the middle.
That was your last note. I thought you were fading away at that part.
No,
what
I was like,
Tom Cruise's
what color?
Eyes?
I wanted to know, like, is that Tom Cruise's eye?
Oh.
And then I Googled, like, what color are Tom Cruise's eyes? And I found all of these weird things where there seems to be like no consensus on what color Tom Cruise's eyes are. Like, I found one website that felt like it might have been translated from another language. But at one point it says like, Tom Cruise's eyes are hazel. And then the next line is like, Tom Cruise's eyes are blue. So no one seems to really know what color his eyes are.
I feel a whole poetry chapbook about this coming up.
In any case, that's my note to Cameron Crowe.
So we don't have a definitive answer on eye color?
No, his eyes seem to be changing.
Like Cameron Crowe says, this movie meets you where you're at, Elizabeth. It can be whatever you want it to be. He did say that.
But I do agree with Veronica that there are like moments where you feel like your heartstrings being tugged.
Absolutely. We haven't talked too much about Cameron Crowe in general, but I was still a pretty big defender of him up until this point. I mean, I, like most people, no offense to Elizabeths in the world, but I did jump off after Elizabethtown. It was so bad. And then he just kind of doubled down on like, hey, I really have completely lost the plot here with all the next movies he made, in my opinion. I don't even remember if he's made something past Aloha. Like, what happened to him? I do know what he made. I liked a really good movie he made, but that's because it was a really good, comprehensive, like 20 or 25 year Pearl Jam documentary. I know he did that a couple of years ago. So that was really good. But yeah, I mean, I saw everything up to that point. I'd seen Singles in a theater, like as a teenager in Seattle. And he was like filming Seattle, and it was just so cool to see. And then I remember going to see Jerry Maguire right around this time of year. I believe it was a Christmas movie. We really picked a weird Tom Cruise movie. Because Jerry Maguire was released around Christmas and has Tom Cruise and is a romantic comedy. And I saw it with my parents, and I loved that, even though that's probably the least cool way to see a romantic comedy in theaters. And then I just was all in on Cameron Crowe. And then Almost Famous, which I know Veronica hates, was, yeah, my favorite movie of that entire year. And I just thought it was the best movie I'd seen. And so by the time Vanilla Sky came out, based on this foreign film that I loved that hardly anyone knew about at that point, yeah, my expectations were just sky high. And then I got the soundtrack. I have the DVD. I mean, I was all in on Vanilla Sky. So I think I'm in on it now still too, but I'm not sure how I'm in. Like, I don't dislike it. It was really interesting to rewatch again, and I would rewatch it again tomorrow. I don't remember having thoughts 20 years ago about what is it even trying to do here? Because the original one has a consistent vision throughout, and the tone is so much different. So it really is like a cover in that way, but it would be more like a cover of Metallica covering a Taylor Swift song. Like, it was just so jarringly bizarre and like off the original thing that I loved that I just couldn't make sense. I can't make sense of it. Last night I was like, what on earth? I don't remember it being this off the wall.
I don't understand this consensus that it's not a romantic comedy. I think it is totally a romantic comedy, or at least romantic comedy has to be in there in the kind of like hybrid genre race, because what else do you need? Like, we have a meet cute between David and Sophia at the party.
Yep.
We have them falling in love over the course of one evening, like people do.
And then obstacles get in the way.
Yeah, and then obstacles get in the way. And it's obviously true love, at least for him. It's like the hinge between, am I going to live my life as a superficial fantasy, or is there a possibility of authenticity that I had previously discounted?
You got the buddy.
It's transformative. There's a little competition, a little Philadelphia Story style thing with him and Brian, like who's going to get the girl. She's this superficial, but I just love Penelope Cruz. Like, even if she doesn't have a lot to work with, I think she sort of vivifies whatever it is that she's sort of meant to be doing. And she's so gorgeous and appealing in this film. They both are. And I mean, the fact that they were involved after the film finished shooting, after he divorced Nicole Kidman, feels like further kind of extra textual proof that this is, in fact, a romantic comedy. And it's also, I mean, it's funny. Like, Let's Meet Again in Another Life Where We Are Both Cats cannot possibly be taken seriously. And I don't think the film is inviting you to.
Well, he meows too. Yeah, he leans into it.
Totally. It's like, it's absurd. And I mean, it feels surrealist to me in the way that like Belle du Jour is surrealist. Like, it's still using all the language of naturalism and like recognizable reality, but everything's a little skewed. Mm-hmm. And so if we are cutting seemingly unmotivated between worlds whose connection is not made clear to us, or if the affects or feelings feel disjointed from the plot events, all of that doesn't bother me at all, because that's the approach to reality that the film seems interested in from its very beginning, right? Like, I mean, the opening sort of gambit of the film, which takes us to this like uncannily empty Times Square that they shot on location with like amazing Radiohead's Everything in Its Right Place, one of the most incredible opening tracks of an album ever. Like,
perfect opening.
I don't know. All of that is so hypnotizing to me. And I sort of stay hypnotized for the rest of the film, willingly and happily so.
It also makes the move that a really good romantic comedy makes, where the key in the end is not who he loves, but can he recommit to loving himself?
Yeah.
Like, that's the key decision at the end there is, like, I do want to try to live my life. I do want to commit to being a person in this world. I do want to try to be somebody better. Mm-hmm. And whether that's trying to be somebody better for someone else or trying to be somebody better just for himself, mm-hmm. I think that is a romantic yeah. comedy move. And there are, like, some scenes that feel very stereotypically rom-com, like the...
But they're announcing themselves as being that.
Yeah, well, the scene where they're drawing each other is a great... I mean, that's a great little scene where she draws the absurd caricature of him that just looks
so
horrible with a giant smile with the dollar signs everywhere. And he draws that, like, perfect portrait of her.
But his lines are so bad in that.
Oh, no, they're terrible.
This is how I see you.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. But I do... I am obsessed with drawings that show up in films, and this is the second drawing of Tom Cruise I have seen in a film, the first being the drawing in Cocktail, where...
Finally, we get to Cocktail, yes.
She draws the picture of Tom Cruise, and it looks nothing like him. It looks like another man. It maybe vaguely even looks like Val Kilmer to me, but in any case... I do think there's some key rom-com moments. But yeah, I think he decides to love himself in a deeper way than he loved himself in the beginning, which was just, I love myself because I'm hot and have lots of money.
And fall asleep watching movies, which is an interesting...
Yeah.
Yeah, he falls asleep to TCM like all the rest of us.
I think part of my problem with it is how heavy-handed some of that stuff felt. I mean, in terms of the some of the dialogue, some of the beating you over the head with... I don't think they could have gotten the sweet and sour line in there more if they tried. Certainly showed up a lot.
Because...
But it's just like, in case you missed it...
Well, there's only so many lines of dialogue you have to work with, right? That's why there's these repetitions, is because he can only lucid dream the stuff that's already happened.
I guess that's... Yeah, that is true.
So we only have like 4 or 5 scenes of dialogue that just keep getting remixed.
Well, and then, and this, again, this to Mr. Eli there, this will sound like I'm making this up, but... We haven't even mentioned, I mean, we mentioned that he's talking to, he's telling the whole story to this court-appointed therapist, but that person is played, which I think is great, by a wonderful, serious Kurt Russell. And it's revealed at the end of the film that Kurt Russell is only there because the surreal dream Tom Cruise's character created him based on, based on Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah,
but then it shows a clip of that, and then it beats you over the head. So I was just like, I would like that to just exist in the ether and not be just beat over the head.
Why do you need it to be subtle, though? I just think, like,
because I like to...
it's a big Hollywood film. Like, why would you have an expectation it would be trafficking in nuance? Film.
I mean, there's some nuance. I mean, to go back to Maverick, we got some nuance in Maverick.
Are you joking? I can't believe that you think Top Gun Maverick is more nuanced than Vanilla Sky. Are you? I mean, Miles Teller's absolute replication of his father that is completely anachronistic. There is no way that person knows the words to Great Balls of Fire. Like, that's not possible.
No, I fully agree with you, Veronica.
That's not fair to pull out the Great Balls of Fire because that was such a good scene. There's a little tension. Veronica swerved on me with liking it.
It's not a swerve. I would never, I literally don't want to do an episode on like a movie I don't like, probably. Like that would be not that enjoyable for me.
Yeah, I also don't want to do one on one I don't enjoy, but I was surprised that I didn't enjoy this one. I until yesterday would have told you that I was where you were. And then I just didn't work for me last night the same way. So I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's true. I didn't think about he would know that. But
there's
the point
only
is,
so many.
I'm carried away into the movie, so I don't think about that. But I am so aware of every single reference that is in.
But the references are so boring. The references are so boring. It's like if you could create any father figure, really, you're going to be like Atticus Finch, yeah. Like the thing I watched in fourth grade. I do think Kurt Russell is great, though.
He's great.
The moment where he realizes that he's a creation is like,
yeah, I like that.
So fucked up, where he's like, I'm real. But even as he's saying it, he's like, oh, shit. Am I not real?
Yeah, when he doesn't know his daughter's names, he's like, oh, maybe I'm not real.
Yeah, I love that. I love that moment. I think it's great.
I would say he is like the only person who seems to be in a normal movie, like as his acting style. Like he kind of like plays that role, which again makes sense in a pop culture sense if it's based on pop culture and he's an imagined person. But he seems to be really playing that role. You could expect someone to play that role while everyone around him is just doing, like, you know, Elizabeth alluded to at the top, just going for it in all kinds of ways all over the place. I don't know. Alicia Witt was in it too. That was another random little cameo.
Yeah, I got excited for Michael Shannon.
Oh yeah. We didn't even say, did we say Michael Shannon? I don't think he was like Michael Shannon then.
I don't think he even talked.
No, he never had a line.
No, he does. He talks.
No.
What does he say? What does he say?
He calls him Face, like when he's trying to escape.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And there's a couple other like confrontational moments where he like yells at him the way like a jailer would.
Well, I also wanted to hear more about like what needle drops you, because you mentioned needle drops that you'll stand by.
That opening scene in Times Square is fucking iconic. Like it's,
yeah,
like,
that's perfect.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Were there other ones besides?
I forget what it's called, but there's another Radiohead one. I like the Joan Osborne. That's a great song.
I don't get why he's doing it. I know him personally, like with the Porpoise song, the monkey thing, like there's a whole story there that kind of makes it make sense. So I put it in there, but then it like cross cuts in with What If God Was One of Us? He brings it back later and that, I'm okay with that one. I did think as he brought it back, because he brought it back for a second spin. What if that was, I mean, echoing the plot and like David Ames is like some like, you know, mythical god and jumps at the end. I don't know. It's not the same as flying too close to the sun, but jumping off a building.
It's a fucking cool song, man. It sounds good the first time and the second time. I just don't know. I feel like you guys are holding this to an insane standard. Like, I'm just like, are we talking about the same movie? Like, what are you expecting? I mean, even the idea that like his taste is basic, of fucking course it is. Like everyone's taste is basic. This is everyone's taste. Like, you really know people that much cooler than David Ames? I doubt it. Like, honestly, I really doubt it.
There was one thing that I read that I remember was saying, like, what about this guy would make you think that he likes any of those things that he likes, which is interesting. Like he doesn't strike, you know, I don't think a lot of the, you know, narcissistic billionaires in the world are jamming to Kid A or, you know,
I've dated this guy. I fucking know who this guy is.
Okay.
This is my ex-boyfriend who I went to high school with, who's obsessed with Bob Dylan, obsessed with TCM, went to film school, has a trust fund. Like, this guy exists. This is a regular guy. Just in his friend group has the best taste.
I believe you.
You know, like he's the cool one in his basic friend group.
Does Tom Cruise's character actually like those things, or does he like that he likes them?
Yeah, why wouldn't he? They're cool things.
Well, I don't know. I mean, and all the French New Wave, I mean, Eli, there's a bazillion French New Wave references and camera work splices. Like,
yeah, there's like jump cuts during a montage. There's two big posters that are like
Jules et Jim and
Breathless.
Oh, Breathless, yeah. Like big, like
really, like really big, kind of catty corner from each other in the apartment. I mean, they look cool. They're like subway posters. They're really big.
Yeah.
And they're attributed in the credits. It's like, here's where we got them. Mm-hmm. Like they're like original posters from the releases of the films.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But so really quick to the masks thing, because I mean, I'm aware that there's two consecutive podcasts we've done in December's now where there's like the splice happens with like the mask on the ground. The splice being the splice between his end of his conscious memory and the beginning of his lucid dream, which we find out at the end. And I would say, like, man, does it feel like there's a similar kind of splice with the mask on the bed and the eyes wide shut thing.
Totally.
And just the whole idea of playing around Tom Cruise's, I remember at the time when it came out, people were like, well, why would you have Tom Cruise in a movie if he's going to spend half the movie in a mask where you can't even see that it's Tom Cruise? And it's a bizarre replica. Ethan had some good line about, like, it looks like a Tom Cruise, like, Halloween costume that's half finished.
No, it's like Michael Myers.
It's so weird.
I'm obsessed with that mask, too, because it's so clearly non-functional. They say, like, oh, it's a facial prosthetic, and it'll move with your face, and it's going to do all these things. But it's just clearly, like, it's not doing any of those things. It's definitely not moving with his face.
It's freaking people out.
It seems to be very flimsy. And when he has the, like, oh, my face got reconstructed, which I know isn't real, but, and she peels it off in the house, which also I was, like, panicking about because I have a lot of medical phobias. And I was like, do not take a wound dressing off in your own home. Like, please have a professional do this.
I didn't know that.
But she's peeling it off, and it's just, like
And then he's Tom Cruise.
plastic. Like, it doesn't do anything. It's so non-functional.
It's like gelatinous.
Yeah, but that also is fascinating to me about this man's subconscious, where he would be like, let me dream up a mask. What mask should I dream up? This very basic blank face.
Because he keeps saying, like, the lucid dream is whatever your mind is making it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it hits that. So why didn't he make it just like something that looks like his face?
Exactly. Like, why did he choose?
Because he wants to be a blank slate.
Yeah. Or he's self-conscious about how he's coasted by on his looks. And
ooh, I like that one. Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I like that. I don't want to be known for my looks anymore, so I'm going to wear this crazy mask.
He probably caught Georges Frenchou's Eyes Without a Face on TCM one night.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Just has that mask in mind
there
or something.
That's very plausible with the TCM that he falls asleep to. Maybe that's
maybe
it.
Maybe that's it.
I'll Google that afterwards.
Well, speaking of this, thinking about the film through the lens of cinephilia, it does do a lot for me. And like specifically the way that we sort of like enter David Ames's crazy apartment at the beginning of the film is so redolent of the way that we see Xanadu at the beginning of Citizen Kane. I know that his nickname with the board of directors is Citizen Dildo. So there's this kind of like explicit, like in the dialogue reference to the Wells film. And I don't know. I just love thinking about Citizen Kane not as a weird puzzle film, which it also totally is, nor as like a mystery to be solved, which it also is, I guess. But it's just a movie that's asking like, well, what is a man's life and how do we know? And that seems to me the absolutely central question of this film too. Mm-hmm. Even if it's maybe like less elegantly explored. I'm not putting them on the same shelf necessarily, but I don't think it's ridiculous to either, like to think about the Citizen Kane style interrogations that are picked up in this film, even if that's an ambition that Crowe may have subconsciously or consciously had and felt some kind of way about the result. But for me, I don't know, there's something similar about the critical temptation to be like, what's really important about Citizen Kane is like the structure and the flashbacks and like the polyvocal narration and what is Rosebud and whatever. But actually, like those soft conversations that he has with his second wife when they first meet in her bedroom seems to me totally similar to the kind of stuff that feels like juicy and enduring maybe about Vanilla Sky.
I love that. I just don't think Vanilla Sky is that good of a movie. But I like that. I like that a lot. I like that Citizen Kane resonance. I think that the problem with this movie for me is that it leans too hard into the puzzle aspect. When I was rewatching it, I was thinking about this Nabokov short story, Signs and Symbols, which is a really obscure reference, but basically it's this short story where, also hard to summarize, there's a elderly couple and they're going to visit their son in a mental institution. And they reveal that the problem with their son is that he has what's called referential mania, where he feels like he's seeing symbols all around him that are symbols of him and they say something about his life. It's kind of like, to me, sounds a little bit like schizophrenia, right? Like, oh, this is talking to me. This is telling me I should do this. The wallpaper means that I should jump out of this window or whatever. So he has this referential mania. When they try to visit him, they're told that he's attempted suicide and they can't see him. And they go home, and then the phone starts ringing at home, and it's a wrong number two times. And then at the very end of the story, the phone rings again, and then the story ends. So you don't know, like, is that the hospital calling to say that he's succeeded in killing himself? Is it the son saying he's escaped? Is it the wrong number again? And Nabokov drops all of these little like symbols in the story itself and these moments where as a reader, you're going, oh, that's important. Oh, what does that mean? What does that mean? But then you realize that you're replicating the mania of the insane person. God. You're searching for symbols where maybe some things aren't symbols at all. Maybe it's just a wrong number. So I feel like for me, this film causes you to search for symbols and references and moments and, oh, that's that, and that's that, and this means that, and that's this, but actually you're becoming as deranged as David Ames.
As pop culture inundated or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the word is there. Because that's all of his reference point. That was a great analogy. I really like that a lot. I've never read that, and I'm going to go read it.
It's short.
Well, that's my favorite kind of reading. Just kidding. I like the deep dives. Really, really, really quick. I did find something that makes it a Christmas movie. I had to freeze frame it. I tried to screenshot it to send you guys, but can't do it on the phone, apparently, if you're streaming through Paramount. On his cryogenic freeze day. Oh, no, but it's in his lucid dream. I don't know if it's real.
It shows really quick. It cuts through and it shows his original life date. And it shows that when he chose to end his life, I guess he has to kill himself in the movie in order to go into the cryogenic chamber or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the date he chooses to do that, it says at the very end of the canister is December 26, 2001.
I wrote down, on a day in late December, you gave yourself to us, is what they say in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that was even more obvious, I guess, than the very quick camera shot of the canister date.
They do say on a day in late December, but that's interesting that it's the day after Christmas.
Mental health issues are at an all-time high around that date as well, that week, as unfortunately a lot of people know. December is a very high, not good month for mental health for people. So. Yes.
Wow. Stay safe out there, kids.
Yeah.
Don't get in cars with Julie Gianni.
Last call.
All right.
Ding, ding, ding. So we are ending this episode as we end every episode, asking our guests to share the last thing they watched recently and then a quick staff reco. Elizabeth, I would love for you to give us two more recommendations in addition to that great short story.
Great. Well, I watch everything in as a mini series these days because I have kids and I'm exhausted, so I can't get through a whole movie without falling asleep. But I did finish Silkwood last night.
Oh.
I don't think that is streaming anywhere. Chris bought a DVD of it. It's a Meryl Streep movie from 1983, and it's a Mike Nichols film. It's a true story, and she plays a worker at a plutonium factory who becomes involved with the union to call for better safety measures, and then question mark, maybe the nuclear guys kill her, question mark, or maybe she just does too many drugs and falls asleep at the wheel. It was really interesting. It was very sad. I guess that's obvious from the description. It's a sad film. Also features a great Cher performance where she barely wears any makeup and she's a weird Oklahoma lesbian working at this factory. And I actually had a lot of empathy for her character where she's clearly in love with Meryl Streep's character, but can't be with her because Meryl Streep's character is in love with Kurt Russell, to bring it full circle back to Vanilla Sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kurt Russell is great in this movie, except he does have a very large Confederate flag over his bed, which is not a great look. But other than that.
What happens when you fall in love with the right person in the wrong life, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And the board of directors that were after the guy in the Vanilla Sky thing and hear the same question, and it's a car crash.
There you go.
Basically the same movie.
Yeah, yeah. Did Craig T. Nelson kill her or did she just fall asleep?
Which I also wondered in Vanilla Sky, is Craig T. Nelson somehow involved in this?
I would love it if he were.
Yeah.
I love a good Craig T. But yeah, that was the last thing I watched. And then I guess the thing that I watched recently that I liked the most, it was Clute, which I had never seen.
Ooh.
And I know that's kind of a basic film school rec maybe for some people, but I had never seen it. I kind of felt like I didn't need to for some reason. It was one of those things where I had heard about it and kind of was okay, Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, cool, whatevs. And I was just so pleasantly shocked and, speaking of dreamy, taken in by this dreamy, surreal, beautiful, quiet, strange film. And I've thought about it a lot since I watched it. I watched it a few months ago and really, really stuck with me.
Mm. I love that movie.
Yeah, that's a great rec.
Yeah, we should do that for a pod at some point. I just was thinking that would be a really fun one to talk about.
Mm, that would be fun.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, God.
Almost every scene I was going, oh, that's gorgeous.
It's like me and Vanilla Sky.
I think we vanillaed the sky. I would say Eli, he does actually put out a little, he makes the background and all the surreal dream stuff this different color that's supposed to be a vanilla sky. And also he talks about Monet painting the vanilla sky. So that's the whole connection to everything.
So you can whisper to your date in the theater, that's the vanilla sky. Every time the sky comes on.
Makes me think of a Pepsi flavor or something.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah, for one summer in 1996. Yeah.
Oh, we did it.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
Be thinking about what one we want to do next year. Got a year to think about it.
Yeah.
Who did suggest this one? I think I might have said it as a joke and then Veronica was into it.
I think you suggested it.
That tracks.
Yeah. And now it feels like the joke was on me. Because you liked it the whole time.
Old time.
Mm-hmm. All right. And thanks, Elizabeth, so much for joining us as we do every episode. If you could let us know where we can find you online so people can check out some of your writing, your books, all the fun things you do in the world.
You can find me on Twitter at EC Cantwell, although to be honest, Twitter is kind of a weird place these days. And you can also find me on Tumblr at E. Cantwell, although I'm still trying to figure out how to use that again because I'm old. And if you know me, I'm also EC Cantwell on Instagram, where I post pictures of my kids.
That's nice.
Coolio, dude.
To read this month's rom-com issue, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR, for now at least, and also at the BWDR podcast, which now has 200 followers. So thank you to whoever is that 200th follow. This episode goes out to you.
Yeah.
And you can also subscribe to our newsletter for the latest updates on every issue straight to your inbox.
Yeah. And I was also going to add, we'll see. It seems like we're announcing a new thing every month based on whatever Elon Musk is doing. But we did join Post this last week. So we are on Post at whatever the Post thing is, and then just Brightwall, all one word.
Okay.
We're trying it all.
Cool. I don't even know what that is. So sick.
I mean, it's something that'll work really, really well until a lot of people join it, and then it'll probably have all the same problems.
Okay, cool.
But for now, it's a nice, chill, monitored place to have, I think they say, casually and enjoyable conversations or something like that. For now, it's good.
Okay.
And we're there. Yeah. And also, please, as we tell you every time, and we're really going to have to start getting more on you because it's not happening. The subscribe part is going well. You guys are doing good on the subscribing. The sharing seems to be pretty good. The rating, Veronica did not say what she normally says here, but I know she wants that to be a little bit higher than the 4.7. And what we really need you guys to do is write us some reviews. So on whatever your podcasting app or whatever of choice, it really helps us out a lot. And I don't really understand why, except for that it bumps stuff up into places where it gets seen more. So you can think of it as directly helping us out, or you can also just visit our Patreon page and throw a little money our way. That's patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom.
Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands. Bye.
Bye. We didn't talk about Benny the dog.
We did not talk about Benny.
Oh no.